Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. Today's Greatest Briton is L.A. Waddell, and I am the solitary host for this podcast. We are going to look at another Greatest Briton this week. In fact, he may not be one of our Greatest Britons. I would definitely say he is a Great Briton. He's definitely an inspiration. And we're going to do that because there really isn't that much news around at the moment. And I've been trying to find some way to talk about this man for quite a while now, because he is a very interesting character, quite eccentric, and he was very well known at the turn of the last century. But because his work has now been deemed politically incorrect, most people have probably never heard of him. His name is Lieutenant Colonel Lawrence Austin Waddell. And I believe he was christened Lawrence Augustine Waddell, but he changed it to Austin. And he's the author of a lot of books with Aryan in the title, because his main interests was trying to find the origins of civilization, the Aryan origins of civilization, and particularly the area in the world that the Aryans came from. But he didn't just do that. He was also the first person to truly document esoteric Buddhism in Tibet, one of the first people to actually go into Tibet, which we will get into as we learn more about him. Well, he was born in 1854 and he died in 1938. So he died just before the Second World War, basically. So before the term Aryan was given a bad name, when it was still in use, basically, to describe the white people that weren't limited to Europe, that were around in India. And according to his theories, they also started the civilization in Sumer in Mesopotamia. As I say, he was a British explorer. He was a professor of Tibetan, a professor of chemistry, and pathology. Now, he was a polymath, like Sir Francis Galton. He was very, very good at all sorts of things. He was an Indian army surgeon. He was a collector in Tibet, particularly of obscure manuscripts. In actual fact, he was tasked by the British government to collect manuscripts in Tibet. And he was hoping that what he would find there would be old manuscripts to do with Atlantis, but he discovered that really Tibet didn't have any manuscripts that were that old, and they actually didn't become Buddhists until about the 7th century AD. So there was nothing there that was before then, basically. And he was also an archaeologist. They call him an amateur archaeologist, but he actually spent a couple of decades devoted to archaeology. He also studied Sumerian and Sanskrit, and he made various translations of seals and other inscriptions. And people do criticize his translations today, although at the time people said, well, you know, his interpretation could just as well be correct as your interpretation. There is nobody that can actually come out with an origin for the Sumerian civilization and the Sumerian language, and he claimed that it actually came from Aryans. It had an Aryan root. His reputation as an Assyriologist gained little to no academic recognition, and his books on the history of civilization have caused controversy. Now, I wouldn't agree with that, because back at the time when he was writing, he had correspondence with quite a few academics, and they haven't really disproved what he said. They've just come out with other translations, which could just as well be wrong. Some of his book publications, however, were popular with the public, and he is regarded by some today to have been a real-life precursor of the fictional character Indiana Jones. Now, I've heard this before, that Indiana Jones was actually based on Waddell, because he, as I say, he was in the army as well. He wasn't some boring guy that just sat at home looking through manuscripts in libraries. He was actually a spy for part of his life, spying on Tibet and dressing up as a Tibetan monk. After he had worked as a professor of chemistry and pathology for 6 years, he became involved in military expeditions across Burma and Tibet. Burma, as we now call it, Myanmar. And between 1885 and 1887, Waddell took part in the British expedition that annexed Upper Burma, which defeated Thibaw Min, the last king of the Konbaung dynasty. So he was a soldier as well, and I believe he was a surgeon when he was actually working with these within the army. After that, he travelled extensively in India throughout the 1890s, including Sikkim and areas on the borders of Nepal and Tibet, and he wrote about the Tibetan Buddhist religious practices he observed there. And he actually purchased a Tibetan Buddhist temple so that he could and got them to build one, basically, and paid for the monks so that he could observe how they practiced their religion. And one of the things that they ended up thinking, they thought that he was a reincarnation of the Buddha. They had this prophecy that there would be a reincarnation of the Buddha in the West, and they believed that L.A. Waddell was that reincarnation of the Buddha. Now, he wasn't actually a Buddhist, and he did have a lot of criticisms of the Tibetan Buddhism, which he thought was a distortion of original Buddhism. He was firmly of the belief that the original Buddha was white. He was from the Sakya tribe. He was a Scythian. In actual fact, he was the man responsible for finding the birthplace of Buddha as well. And he was searching around British-controlled India in search of Kapilavastu, the Buddha's supposed birthplace. Kapilavastu had previously been identified as the village of Buila in India, which Waddell and other Orientalists concluded to be incorrect. They were searching for the birthplace by taking into account the topographical and geographical hints left by the ancient Chinese travellers Fa Hien and Huan Qiang. And Waddell was the first to point out the importance of a discovery of a pillar, which was called a Shocker's Pillar in Negleva in 1893. And he, from the position of that pillar, he estimated Buddha's birthplace to be somewhere which was called Lumbini. He subsequently corresponded with the government of India and arranged for the exploration of that area. And he was actually appointed to conduct the exploration to recover the inscriptions and everything else, but at the last moment, due to adverse circumstances, he was prevented from doing that, and a Mr. Alwar Führer, I mean, what kind of a coincidence is that? The man is called Alwar Führer. He was sent to carry out the exploration arranged by him, and he found the grove and the inscriptions, everything, exactly at the spots that Waddell had told him he would find them. And the actual inscriptions on the pillar were buried 1 meter below the surface. Now, I think it was probably after this that the Tibetans decided that he must have been what is called a reflex of the Buddha. Stationed with the British Army in Darjeeling, I believe that's famous for its tea, Waddell learned the Tibetan language and even visited Tibet several times secretly in disguise. He was the cultural consultant on the 1903 to 1904 British invasion of Tibet, led by Colonel Sir Francis Edward Younghusband, and was considered alongside Sir Charles Bell as one of the foremost authorities on Tibet and Tibetan Buddhism. And the reason why the British had to go into Tibet is because the Russians had been going in there, and the Tibetans were allowed to come into India, but the Indians and the British were not allowed to go into Tibet. And they had this concern that the Russians were going to make treaties with Tibet, take over Tibet, and then they would have a route down into India. So they had a bit of a skirmish with the Tibetans, and then they came to an agreement, and they came to a trade agreement, and he was able to find out everything that he could about the Tibetans. There's a very big book that he's written, which is called The Buddhism of Tibet, or Lamaism, and he also wrote another book called Lhasa. Very big books, basically, about Tibet, and he was very well known for this, but he had already got this bug of trying to find out these Aryan origins. As I say, he knew that the Buddha was originally Aryan. He studied archaeology and ethnology in between his military assignments across India and Tibet, and his exploits in the Himalayas were published in his highly successful book, Among the Himalayas, in 1899. And he basically went exploring all across the Himalayas and discovering all sorts of things that we didn't know about before. Various archaeological excavations were also carried out and supervised by Waddell across India, including Pataliputra, of which he did not receive recognition of discovery until long after his death in 1982 by the government of Bengal. And Pataliputra was a huge city. Around about 300 BC, it was known as one of the largest cities in the world, and it had just completely disappeared. The fact they had this huge city over in India, and they had universities over there, I mean, just tells you that these were white people that were over there, because when the British went to India in the 17th century or whatever, it was all in a lot of ruins. They'd forgotten how to take their waste away, basically. I mean, looking at these cities that they found, this Pataliputra, and even before that, in the Indus Valley, there was a city that they found there that was, I think it was 1500 BC, and it had a sewage system, so people could go to the bathroom and it would be taken outside into sewers, it would go out into the streets and it could be then cleaned up. And the way that the city was built, we can see that there was planning in this. There was basically the first example that we have of proper city planning before the place was built. So these were highly advanced people that they had over there in India. And he thought that they originated in Cappadocia, which is now Turkey, with Troy on the end of it, and then Cappadocia, and then there was another country there, and then you get to Mesopotamia. So you can see that this theory that the Aryans began in Cappadocia and made their way into Mesopotamia, into the Fertile Crescent, it's very plausible. And his discoveries at Pataliputra were published in an official report in 1892. But as I say here, he wasn't actually recognized for discovering it for another 100 years. During the 1890s, Waddell specialized in Buddhist antiquities and became a collector. And he was paid to do this by the British government. They gave him a lot of money to collect as many Tibetan manuscripts as he could for the museums. And unfortunately, he didn't actually get to meet the Dalai Lama, because when they went in there, when they went into Tibet after having this battle, the Dalai Lama fled. But after that, he was told that the Dalai Lama wanted to get into correspondence with him, wanted to write to him, but I think unfortunately he died before they were actually able to begin any correspondence. Between 1895 and 97, he published his Reports on Collections of Indo-Scythian Buddhist Sculptures from the Siwat Valley. So we can see there that he's saying that these were Scythian peoples, but they were in India, the white people that were in India. In 1893, he also read a paper to the International Congress of Orientalists on some newly found Indo-Grecian Buddhistic sculptures from the Siwat Valley. And in 1895, he published his book Buddhism of Tibet, or Lamaism, which was one of the first works published in the West on Buddhism. As a collector, Waddell had come across many Tibetan manuscripts and maps, but he was disappointed to not find a single reference to a lost ancient civilization, which he had hoped to discover. And that was his main drive, really, for wanting to go into Tibet. So that must have been quite a disappointment for him. In 1908, Waddell began to learn Sumerian, and this was a big turning point in his career. And in his later career, he turned to studying the ancient Near East, especially Sumeria, and dedicated his time to deciphering or translating ancient cuneiform tablets or seals, most notably including the Kush King List. I think he spent about 20 years learning how to translate from Sumeria. And this is the first time that they discovered these cuneiform tablets. It was the first time we really had a window into the past, 3,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago, And it must have been very exciting. I think this was one of the really, one of the most positive things that there was about the British Empire, is that the field of archaeology began, and we had educated white people that were looking around these old ruins and discovering our history, basically, our lost history of when we were in that part of the world before we became limited to just living within Europe. This Kush King list became very, very important for him as well, because it was from that that he discovered that it was the same kings written about in Sanskrit, in the Vedas and in the Mahabharata, and also written about in the Egyptian hieroglyphs, which he extrapolated from that they were the same kings, basically, that civilization doesn't just spring up by accident, but just because the conditions are right, but that civilization is spread by a particular people. This theory is called pan-Sumerism, and we'll get into it a little bit more later. But this Kush King list was very important that he translated. In 1911, Waddell published two entries in the Encyclopaedia Britannica. By 1917, he was fully retired and first started exclusively writing about Aryans, beginning in an article published in the Asiatic Review entitled Aryan Origin of the World's Civilization. From the 1920s, Waddell published several works which attempted to prove an Aryan or Indo-European origin of the alphabet, and the appearance of Indo-European myth figures in ancient Near Eastern mythologies. And by that they mean Hittite, Sumerian, Babylonian. And one of the main ones we have is the figure of the hero slaying the dragon, which we still have today with George and the dragon, St. Michael and the dragon. And this goes back to this imagery in Sumeria, in Babylon, and it's Indo-European as well. So that shows there is this link between all those civilizations, including our own. And the foundation of his argument is what he saw as a persistence of cult practices, religious symbols, mythological stories and figures, and god and hero names throughout the Western and Near Eastern civilizations, also basing his arguments on his deciphered Sumerian and Indus Valley seals and other archaeological findings. As what he discovered was that there were the same names for things, like Indra, Adam, Thor. They're all variations of the same name. When you get different languages, certain letters get changed for other letters, and you find that with all these words. And when you do that, that's when you find that it was the same names for these characters. So that was one of the discoveries that he made. Waddell's voluminous writings after his retirement were based on an attempt to prove that the Sumerians, who he identified as Aryans, as the progenitors of other ancient civilizations, such as the Indus Valley civilization and the ancient Egyptian one, to the classic Greeks, Romans, and ancient Britons, to whom they, the Sumerians, passed on from hand to hand down the ages the torch of civilization. And I think he's probably correct in this. I mean, there is so much evidence for it. In the Indus Valley, which is now Pakistan, they found all these seals with the same images on of it that they had in the seals in Sumeria. And then you put that together with these king lists, which talk about the same kings. And it's basically saying that, I mean, his theory is civilization began in Cappadocia. It then went to Sumeria. From Sumeria, it then went to the Indus Valley and to Egypt and then to Crete and then to the Greeks. And it was the same people that started it all off. But of course, as we know what happened, they then started interbreeding with the Aborigines. And once they do that, they lose the ability to maintain the civilization, and it fails. And he discovered this as well, but he thought this was a good thing. He thought it was a wonderful thing that the Aryans were civilizing the Aborigines and making them into honorary Aryans and even into marrying with them. And I guess he didn't put two and two together and realize that that was the reason why these civilizations fell. He is perhaps most remembered for his controversial translations, the Tablet of Kish containing the Sumerian king list, the Bowl of Utu, which he saw as a proto-grail, and the Newton Stone in Scotland, as well as his British Edda. Waddell's translation of the Elder Edda, which he claimed was written in Old English and not Icelandic. And we'll look at all three of these in detail. From the Kish tablet, he showed that the Sanskrit king lists were exactly the same as the Sumerian and Egyptian king lists. And there were others that were saying that this Kish tablet has to be false because this other tablet we've got doesn't mention those kings. And that was their evidence for saying that he was wrong. And yet this Kish tablet, it was written at the time with the kings that were on it when they were alive. So it was a primary source document. That was his argument. And the other Assyriologist's argument was, well, those kings on that Kish tablet don't appear on this other tablet that we've got. So it's a pretty flimsy argument that they made to try and discredit him. And the bowl that he found, this Utu bowl, he found that beneath a temple in Nippur in Sumeria. And he theorized that it was the bowl that was spoken of in the Edda, which told the story of the rise of civilization in Cappadocia. So the first of these that we will look at is the British Edda. And I've got a copy of the British Edda. It's fairly interesting. It's got a lot of illustrations in it. There was a time when Amazon were selling all his books, and some of them they were selling very, very cheaply. But I think with this purge that they have recently had, the fact that a lot of his work had Aryan in the title has meant that most of it you can't get now. So I'm very pleased that I did buy as many of them as I could when they were available. The title of the book, The British Edda, was chosen because of Waddell's belief that the work upon which his translation was based, the Elder Edda, was mistakenly believed by many to be written in Scandinavian. And that's what people think. They think the Edda is something that comes from the Nordic countries because it came from Iceland. But Iceland was peopled by people from Britain at this time. Waddell objected to this theory, explaining that the language had been found to be from an Icelandic family that had originally come from Scotland. Due to this, Waddell used the word British in the title to emphasize where the Elder Edda had come from. Waddell also went on to state that many other Eddic poems had been written in the British Isles before and up to the 6th century, but that most of them had been eradicated in the 11th century by Christian missionaries, contributing to the confusion. And the Edda came from Snorri Snorlason. I think he was a Christian monk that wrote these things down in the 11th century. But when you think Iceland was peopled with peoples from Scotland, then the idea that they may have actually brought to Iceland from Scotland these ideas and that they were their poems, that makes a lot of sense. And also when you think that we had Norsemen over here in England, and what he is saying is essentially that this was written in Old English, which was Old Norse, basically. One of the subjects discussed in the British Edda is the genesis of civilization, which, as stated by Waddell, was commonly believed in the pagan days in Britain to be in Cappadocia and Eden, but was very broad due to the lack of knowledge about the region beyond mere stories and also no knowledge of specific place names. So the British people and the people back then, they knew that the genesis of civilization, the birth of man, all the start of everything had happened in the Near East. I think you find that also in these stories of the men coming from Asia, men of Asgard. I forget what it is, not the Rig Veda, other ones that you get, the Nordic ones, they talk about the men coming from Assyria, which, you know, is pretty close to Asia. When you think about it, Asia Minor, which is where Constantinople was once seen as the center of Europe. Also there, you've got Troy, which is supposedly where the British people originally came from. So you've got that central part there, And very close to it, you've got the Holy Land, and then you've got Mesopotamia, the Fertile Crescent. We know today that civilization began in the Fertile Crescent. And his theory was that the story of Genesis, which is the creation of man, he saw it that it was really the creation of civilization. And that was what was being referred to. And he found echoes of the story in Genesis. He found these echoes of that in the British Edda. And also echoes of it in these Sumerian tales. And I look at that as these were white people, and they all had different variations of explaining their stories, basically. The fact that they all slightly differ from one another doesn't say that somebody copied theirs from somebody else. To me, it says that they were different witnesses, and they had different ways of explaining what they were talking about, different allegories, different idioms that they used. From there, it talks of the civilizing of the Edenite savages. And this is because the story that he talks about is these Cappadocians, these Aryans, they go to war against this serpent cult in Cappadocia, in this place that's called Eden. And they go to war against them, and that's when this bowl is taken from them, and they defeat them. And then they civilize them, and then the king marries the serpent priestess, who is obviously of the blood of this serpent cult, of this Edenites. And he thinks that this Edda is a song of celebration of this. It's a song of celebration of defeating the savages, bringing them civilization, and then breeding with them, which to me, I mean, that's the downfall. That's been the downfall of all the empires. It's not something that should be celebrated. And that was what was really going on here. They were building an empire. He then talks about the eventual marriage of this serpent priestess. And she's called Eve or Ifo or Guanifo or Guinevere, which fits in with Guinevere. Because he says that the guy that she marries is King Herthor, Arthur, or Adam. So we have these parallels of the stories of Arthur and Guinevere and the Holy Grail thousands of years later. And we have the originals of this story in this Edda, which is talking about the beginnings of civilization. Now, it also talks about the slaying of Abel, who he calls Balder, by Cain, their son. So he claims that Cain is the son of Adam or Thor or Arthur from his marriage to Eve. And he claims that Abel is the bad guy in this. See, now this is a clue to me. This says that these people that he's talking about here, the ones that are singing this song of celebration of civilizing the savages, they weren't the good guys. They were the race mixers, and they were encouraging the race mixing. And they've turned this around so that Cain is the good guy and Abel is the bad guy. Because he also claims that these people were Hittites. And I've always thought, okay, he says they're Hittites. They're from that area. They're from that area. But were they of the same genetics as the Hittites? Because we know the Hittites were part Canaanite. They were of mixed race. They had origins in Cain, basically, and mixing in with the Aborigines. So when he was saying that these Aryans that came from that area, I thought he must have been talking about Aryans that were in that area after they had moved the Hittites out. But now learning about this, that he claims that Cain was their hero, and they then encouraged the interbreeding with the non-whites. I'm starting to think, well, maybe the civilization was brought about by the Canaanites. I mean, it would make sense, really, because the Bible tells us, or the Book of Enoch tells us, that the angels taught these arts and these secrets to these Cainites that they shouldn't have had. And taught them the arts of war, and they fought amongst themselves and corrupted all the flesh on the earth and mixed their blood with other beings that they shouldn't have done, and encouraged all this race mixing. So maybe that is what is going on here. It's very interesting that he discovered this, and it ties in with research that people are doing today into this biblical understanding, this slightly different biblical understanding to the one that the church has. Getting back to this bowl that he found, which is mentioned in this Edda, the bowl is a sacred bowl that is taken from the serpent cult, and Waddell believed it had been broken and then buried in the foundations of this temple at Nippur. So the fact that he had this bowl and he was able to locate it sort of says that yes, that is what was going on here, because you don't normally find a bowl with these inscriptions on it just randomly buried anywhere. And the inscriptions on it were saying this was buried by the priest of this king who he identifies with Adam. Obviously, I think this is mixed up because Cain was not Adam's son. So if this was Cain, which it may well have been because he was encouraging the race mixing here, then that wasn't his father. It wasn't Adam, rather, wasn't his father. It was obviously somebody maybe calling himself by that name as a title, because it would probably had it probably became a similar title like king, with Adam being the first man, or Adam being the first man who was worthy of note, should we say. I mean, even if you're not a Christian, and what we can see from this is that these names and these titles, they weren't just limited to the Israelites or whatever. These names and these titles go back to the original Aryans, the original white people on the earth. This oral tradition of stories was written down on parchment by the learned. And this is, he's talking here about back in before 1000 AD. And they were composed into what is known as the Elder Edda. So what actually became monks, Snorri Sturluson, he was the guy that wrote down the Edda, wrote it down on parchment and saved it so that we have it today. And it's basically these oral stories. Waddell also explained that other works that copied down the stories were made, but all of these have been destroyed by Christian missionaries in Britain, leaving only the one work. These stories returned to the common populace in the 12th century by being melded into the Arthurian legends, while the original sources, held by the Cappadocians, the Trojans, and the Sumerians, were lost. And I would take issue with him saying that it was Christian missionaries that destroyed these records, because it was Christian missionaries, or Christian monks rather, that actually wrote them down and saved them. Snorri Sturluson was a Christian monk. It's the same with standing stones from the stone circles. You find them in churches today. They put in churchyards to keep them safe so they don't get used for making gateposts out of them, or used for making buildings with. And it was the monks that knew how to read and write that would write down and record these poems and these memories. The Newton Stone, which he found in Scotland, which I mentioned earlier, this has this writing on it that they've never been able to work out exactly what alphabet it is or exactly what it is. And he identified it as being in a Phoenician script. And he said it was a Cadmean Phoenician script, which is from Cadmus, one of these famous early Phoenician kings. It was written rather than right to left, it was written left to right. And it proved the existence of a king called Partholon that we're told in our early records that actually came to Britain. And it proves the veracity of the ancient histories that speak of the Phoenicians trading with the Britons, and that the Britons started out as Trojans. They started out as Phoenicians. He says that the Phoenicians, the Hatti and the Trojans are all one people, basically. And I think what we had here, I think we had a mixed race type, we had a Canaanite type, and they were living alongside the Aryan type, and that's what we're told in the Bible, and that's why we've always had these problems, and that's why the empire has always fallen to race mixing, because we've got a force among us that tries to encourage this race mixing, and we've got a force among us that says no, you don't want to do that because that's going to destroy everything. But unfortunately, the race mixing ones and the ones promoting that have always won up until this point. That's why we only have Europe left now. So he found this stone. It's in a stately home, I believe it is now. It's not in the original place that it was, with this writing on it that identifies it as being Phoenician. And alongside that, we have all these pre-Roman coins in Britain that were put out by our kings, and they have all these symbols on them, the same symbols that we see on the Sumerian cuneiform tablets. On these Sumerian tablets, they had like little circles and little symbols to symbolize the gods and symbolize their heroes and various other things. And we find exactly the same symbols on the pre-Roman coins that we have in Britain, which provides another link to the Sumerians and to the Phoenicians. Now, in his book, The Phoenician Origins of Britons, Scots, and Anglo-Saxons, that's the first book that I purchased by him, he argues for a Syro-Hittite and Phoenician colonization of the British Isles. Obviously, when he says Syro-Hittite, he is not talking about the Syrians that are in Syria now. He is talking about Aryans that were in that area. And we had Hittites in a similar area there. But when we look at the stone images that we have of Hittites, they look more similar to today's Jews than they do to any Aryans. And of course, we're told in the Bible that the Hittites were a Canaanite tribe. So this is why I think that maybe that area was named after the Hittites. It had Aryans in there after the Hittites had been removed. And at this time, when you're talking about the beginning of the Sumerian civilization, also around about the time that the Bible talks about the Tower of Babel and the Babylonian Empire, you had Aryans and you had Canaanite types and you had mixed race types, and they were all part of the same empire. And what he's talking about here with this British Edo is like a celebration of that. It's an encouragement of that. So, you know, it's very plausible. His theory seems very plausible to me. He argued for a Syro-Hittite and Phoenician colonization of the British Isles, turning to British folklore that mentions Trojans, such as the Brutus Stone in Totnes and Geoffrey of Monmouth, and place names that supposedly preserve the Hittite language and inscriptions as evidence. And it also says in the biography that I've been reading that Geoffrey of Monmouth claimed to have been given the information that he got to put into his History of the Kings of Britain. It's not a work of fiction in any way. The History of the Kings of Britain was the history that the British people knew as their history at the time. And being descended from Brutus the Trojan Prince is a very important part of that. As I say, Troy is just down from Cappadocia, which Waddell identifies as being Hittite. And also he says this name Hittite, Hat or Cad or Cash, Catty, these are all names that mean the same thing. And of course then you get the Kshatriyas, which were the warrior tribe that were in India, and they were also called Bharats, which is exactly the same as Brits. Basically, you had the Western Brits in Britain, the Phoenicians in Britain, and you had the Eastern Brits, which were the Phoenicians that were in India. And there is an Indian tradition that the Kshatriyas came to Europe, and that's where Europeans come from originally. It was from these Kshatriyas. But the point is that I would make is that they were Aryan, but we also had these Canaanite mixed race types that were there with us, that were causing these problems. According to Waddell, the unknown script on the Newton Stone is Hitto-Phoenician, and his translation is as follows. This sun cross, which is a swastika, was raised to Bil, or Bel, the god of sunfire, by the Kassi, or Kassi Balani, of caste of the Siluri, subclan of the Kilani, or Hittite palace dwellers, the Phoenician named Ikar of Kilikia, the Parat, or that is Barat or Brihat or Briton. So we see that there that the letter P can be substituted for the letter B, the letter W can be substituted for the letter A, and that is still the same in Wales today. They use the letter W for an O sound or an A sound. So that just shows you that these letters that we use in our words can be changed around. Interesting that we had a king called Cassibelani, I think. And we've got this word here, Cassi, which I think it means king, which turns up a lot in early English and also, or early Brittonic, I should say. And also this mention of the swastika, which is now obviously not politically correct, but the swastika was something that was used by the Aryans for thousands of years. And he would put swastikas on his books. Around the time this was written, Rudyard Kipling was putting swastikas on his books. Baden Powell was putting swastikas on his scout badges. It did not have any negative connotations, and it was a symbol to show that there was continuation of civilization, continuation of white people, and I think it was basically a flowering of knowledge of just who we are and just how far back our history goes, and that we aren't just indigenous to Britain or Europe. We spread out all across the world, and we are the civilization bearers. Of course, we're not taught this today. The theory that we're taught today is that when the conditions are right, when the environment is right, civilization just occurs. But that doesn't explain why it never occurred in amongst the Negroes in Africa, does it? Or why it never occurred in amongst the Aborigines in Australia. Now, Brutus of Troy, Waddell also regarded to be a real historical figure. I think he's a historical figure. There's plenty of historical references to him. In a chapter entitled Coming of the Britons or Aryan Brito-Phoenicians under King Brutus the Trojan to Albion about 1103 BC, Waddell writes, "This migration of King Brutus and his Trojan and Phoenician refugees from Asia Minor and Phoenicia to establish a new homeland colony in Albion, which event the British Chronicle historical tradition places at 1103 BC, was probably associated with and enforced by not merely the loss of Troy, but also by the massacring invasion of Hittite Asia Minor, Cilicia, and the Syrian Phoenician coast of the Mediterranean by the Assyrian king Tiglath-Pileser I, about 1107 BC to 1105 BC. And Tiglath-Pileser I, he is spoken about in the Bible. Some other connections that he makes is with the names of places in Britain, such as Surrey. He says that derives from the word Syria. I mean, the book itself is just full of different names for counties, and showing that they originate in these Phoenician words. Like the Trinovantes, the tribe that were in the London area. It says that comes from Troynova, which means New Troy, because when the Trojans came here to Britain, they named the cities after where they had just been, which is a tradition that we do, of course. We have New England, we have New York, we have lots of places that we New South Wales. This is something that we still do. So he was suggesting that that's what the Trojans did. They called it New Troy. And that was the original name of London. There is a lot of evidence to back up his theories. And of course, there's also Christian identity evidence, which ties in with a lot of his theories as well. The only really real difference is that he saw these Hittites, the people that were encouraging the race mixing, as good. I mean, I can't really square that in my mind, how he saw that as good, but he did. He thought the Edda was a celebration of that. He also had a problem with people that were trying to promote the idea that the Sumerian language had to be Semitic and had to have come from what they saw as Jews. And it was basically, it was some Assyriologists that were saying this, this is a Semitic language. It can't be an Aryan language. It has to be a Semitic language. And he had a lot of arguments with these researchers And they weren't Jews. He wasn't, I don't think he was anti-Semitic. He wasn't speaking out against the Jews at all in any way. But because he referred to them as Semitic researchers and used the word Semitic to the name, meaning that they promoted this Semitic theory, he gets criticized today. Some people will criticize him for being an anti-Semite. And it's accepted today that the Sumerian language did not originate in Semitic sources. It's not a Semitic language. And his main theory, as I say, is that it was an Aryan language and that it came from these Cappadocians who, after civilizing the savages in their area, then went into Sumer and built Nippur and Iraq and all these other Sumerian cities, and then spread out from there to India, to the Indus Valley, and built cities there, and spread to Egypt and built these cities there. The suggestion of a non-Semitic source for the Sumerian language was still being argued over in Waddell's time, and in his works Aryan Origin of the Alphabet and Sumer-Aryan Dictionary in 1927, Waddell attempted to show that the Sumerian language was from an Aryan root. He went on to write The Aryan Makers of Civilization in 1929, and Egyptian Civilization, Its Sumerian Origin and Real Chronology in 1930, where he revised the conventional dates for these ancient civilizations and king lists. For example, he believed the early dynastic period of Egypt to be 2700 BC and not 3100 BC. So this formed a part of his theory as well, that there was a 400-year difference and that the mainstream scholars had got that wrong. And if you add this 400-year difference in, you see that these kings that were on this Kish list, that's when they were, and they tied in with the other ones. He argued that Menes, the Egyptian king, was also Manes Tuzu, the son of Sargon, who in turn was King Minos of Crete, because Tuzu, I think that means warrior. So it's just exactly the same, isn't it? Menes, Manes, Minos, it's the same person. He was saying that these other parts, Egypt and Crete, they were like franchises from the same place. Sargon II, I believe, was they call him the Semitic king that invaded Sumer, and he was able to take over. Now, if these Hittites had encouraged this race mixing in Sumer, then that would have been the reason why they were able to be defeated by Sargon II, or Sargon of Akkad, who instituted the Akkadian civilization there. And don't forget, when they're talking about Semitic, there is this confusion, because people think, well, it means people that look like the Jews today, or it could be people that were descended from Shem, which would have meant that they were white if they were descended from Shem. The word Semitic itself refers to the language. It doesn't actually refer to a specific genetic type. It refers to the language. It's the same as when we talk about Latin being the language that the Latins speak. The Latin people are named after the language that they speak, but it doesn't mean that they're Roman or they are descended from Romans. And you get mestizos that speak Latin languages. You couldn't say that they were the same as the Spaniards. So it may have been that Sargon of Akkad, he may well have been white and nothing to do with the Jewish people. In which case, that makes sense to me, that we had this race mixing civilization in Sumer and Babylon, as we're told in the Bible, and then you've got an Aryan type that goes in there and takes it over. Also, we've got something else that he talked about, the Indus Valley civilization, where he got these seals from that showed they had the same images on them, the same script on them as the ones that were in Sumeria. This was about 1,000 years before we know of the Aryan invasion of India, because of course people say, well, yes, we know of the Aryan invasion of India. We know that there were Aryans there, but he's talking about 1,000 years before then. And right up until very recently, the argument was that the civilization that was there, that's the one I was telling you about earlier with all the facilities to transport sewage away, they were trying to say that that was a Dravidian civilization. It was these dark-skinned peoples from India. It was their civilization. Well, they've actually done genetic tests on some of the bodies that were found there, and the results of that were released last year, and they're quite clearly Aryan. They're quite clearly white. They look slightly different to us today, because obviously it was 3,000 years ago, and you are going to have a slight change in features due to just adaptation to wherever we are, but they are quite clearly white and not Dravidian. So I think he has been proved correct in that these were Aryans that were in this that started this Indus Valley civilization. For Waddell, the earliest ancient rulers, or the mythological kings of Sumer, Egypt, Crete, and the Indus Valley civilizations, were all identical Aryan personages. They were the same people. Again, this is why we have these gods, these heroes, that do the same feats, they carry out the same feats, but they've got different names in different parts of the world, is because they are the same people. And we deified our ancient kings as well. A lot of the gods with a small g that we used to have were actually deified kings. To support his revised chronology, Waddell had acquired and translated several artifacts, including the Kish King's List and the Bowl of Utu, and he was widely praised for his acquisition of the latter. That was the bowl that he found at the temple of Nippur. I mean, the only way he could have known that is from this Edda, this translation that he had made, it being correct. How else is he going to know that that's where this bowl is going to be? And he found this bowl, and it had the translation on it, which said that that was who it was that buried it there. It was the priest of Adam, or Indra. I remember the Hindu god Indra. That's the same person as Adam, and that's the same person as Thor. All these words are just different names of the same characters, according to him. The University of Glasgow now holds all Waddell's papers and his manuscript collection, and it's a huge collection. I think it is actually catalogued online. Because don't forget, he was tasked by the British government with buying as many of these Tibetan manuscripts as he could. And, I mean, it must be an amazing collection to look at. I don't know if it's actually open to the public. You probably don't know that. Most people don't know that much about this man, but I think he was probably very well known when he was alive. And he died in 1938, the same year he completed writing The Trojan Origin of World Civilization. And this book was never published. Now, I'd really like to have a read of that, especially if he had finished writing that. Why wasn't it published? Why wasn't it published after his death? It's really sad that it wasn't, because, I mean, that's a really interesting title, isn't it? And to think that would have been the culmination of all his work, after all the things he had discovered, all his research, and he was going to put it all into that one book, and we've never had a chance to read that book. It's a great shame. Perhaps one day it will be published. I mean, there is an interest in him. As I say, there is now a biography of his life that is available in paperback form. It was only available in hardback right up until now. I think it got published about 10 years ago. And it does summarize all these discoveries that he made. It's a very interesting book. Well, anyway, I hope you enjoyed learning about L.A. Waddell today. As I say, he's not really one of our greatest Britons, but he certainly is a great Briton. It just shows you the sort of people that we are, the sort of inquisitive, adventurous people that we are. And we're not afraid to stand out from the crowd and say, look, this is what I believe. This is where my research has taken me. Regardless of if people are going to criticize you, you have to believe in yourself, and you have to follow the truth, and you have to follow where that takes you. And he is a really good example of that. And I do recommend reading his books if you can find them. As I say, they were a lot of them on Amazon a while back, but I'm not so sure they are still there. Thank you very much for listening. If you want to hear more about our greatest Britons, it features in the second half of the podcast Real Britannia, which we produce here at Radio Albion every Monday. Or you can wait until the separate pieces are edited together into separate programs like the one you have just heard.